Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good Monday morning, everyone. My first guest today is one of the most high-profile critics of the Obama health reform plans. Betsy McCoy first rose to prominence as a critic of the Clinton health reform plan in 1994. She was on this program for that at the time. She then went on to become Governor Pataki's first lieutenant governor, as you may know, and is now chairman of the Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths. She also recently resigned from her position with a corporation that sells medical devices just last month after appearing on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart to make her case on health care. But Betsy McCoy, welcome back to WNYC. Good morning.
Well, thank you. I am glad to be back. And, you know, I just heard on the news report before we began to speak an update on swine flu, and I did want to mention before we get into what's going on in Washington how important it is for hospitals everywhere, including right here in New York, to double up their attention to effective infection prevention, because the same rigorous procedures that can protect patients from the bacterial infections we all fear when we go into the hospital, MRSA, VRE, C. diff, those are the same precautions that are going to be even more important when more and more people start going into the emergency room or reporting to the hospital with swine flu. And so I know my organization, we're working very hard to increase awareness in the hospitals and bring more information to the hospitals about the importance of hospital infection prevention.
Right.
And people at home need to be aware that if they feel sick, going to the emergency room is not the best idea.
So that's with your Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths hat
right.
on. I want to do a little bit of old business, going back to 1994, because you went after the Clinton plan, famously, way back when, for warning it would lead us into more managed care, where we would have less choice of doctors and treatments. And in the years since, would you say that the market has done exactly that, as insurance companies try to make more money by managing the decisions of doctors and patients and deciding which ones to approve?
Well, actually, in the 1990s, and I was very much a part of this, there was quite a public rebellion against the tightest restraints of managed care. I'm sure you remember how hard many of us worked to stop those drive-through mastectomies where women were forced out of the hospital literally hours after breast surgery and preposterously told that it would bring them closer to their husbands if their husbands had to change their bandages and remove their drains, things like that.
Right.
And also, we worked very hard to stop a drive-through childbirth. Believe it or not, women were told that they had to leave the hospital 24 hours after childbirth. Literally, there were women waiting in the parking lots of the hospitals in labor so that the clock wouldn't start ticking on their allowed hospital time. So thanks to many state lawmakers and then finally to Congress, a lot of the worst abuses of managed care, tightly managed plans, were eliminated. Insurance company abuses are still terrible, and one of the aspects of federal legislation that I do support is curbing those abuses. But if you look at the data today, more and more people who have the opportunity to pick their health plan are in what they call PPOs, preferred provider organizations, that have fewer tight controls than HMOs.
That's true. But you made the government the bogeyman back then, not the market. Were you unfair to government relatively?
That's not true. Let me point out that one of my major concerns with the Clinton plan is that it would have required people to go into these low-budget HMOs. Recall from a close reading of that plan that it wasn't a single-payer plan. It was a plan that required everyone to enroll in the health plans that were approved by regional exchanges. And there were going to be price limits on those plans, but necessarily as a result, limits on the care you could get into those plans. The Clinton plan actually made insurance companies the rationers of care. And one of the concerns I have about the current legislation, particularly H.R. 3200, that 1,018-page House bill, is that it would do very much the same for people who are in private plans. You've heard the president and others say, if you like your health plan, you can keep it. if you have one of those great Blue Cross Blue Shield plans that let you go to any doctor anytime, or if you have one of those high deductible plans that young people like because they can still afford their car payments if they buy it, that those will be history. The bill makes it very clear that after a grace period, that's on page 16, you will have to enroll in what the government calls a qualified plan. It's a one-size-fits-all plan that will be, the design of it will actually be released about 18 months after the bill is passed.
Now wait, I haven't read that aspect of it or other commentary on that aspect of it, but I'm finding a little bit hard as I hear that and for the first time and sit here to say that, to believe that the government is going to funnel us into a one-size-fits-all private plan, when they keep talking about expanding competition and make sure there are enough insurers in areas that don't have them now and wanting to add the public option,
Brian,
as an additional competitor.
You're quite right that the reassuring language is at odds with the actual words of the bill. I have the bill here, and on pages 16, it says that you will, if you get your insurance through your employer will have a grace period and then will have to enroll you in what's called the qualified plan. If you get your insurance yourself rather than at work, you won't have that grace period. As soon as any of the language in the current insurance contract you have changes, the copay, the deductible, or the other terms, you will be required to drop that and get into the qualified plan.
When you say qualified plan, you're using the singular plan, like there's one qualified plan.
Well, the way the bill is written, it says that a Health Choices Commissioner will be appointed by the president, and the Health Choices Commissioner will design what the basic plan must be. And the singular is used there, basic plan.
But the basic plan, as I understand it, means minimum requirements to be given to all Americans who have health insurance
as coverage.
Well, not given to them.
Well,
of course, they have to be
required to buy it.
Right. People will be required to buy health
insurance. That's right.
Care, health insurance, or provided for their employees.
That's right. So high deductible plans, PPOs, many types of insurance that people now have will not be included because that basic plan, we haven't seen it. Have you ever heard that old expression like buying a pig in a poke? We're supposed to approve this legislation and then we will hear the specifics about how much the plan will cost you, how much leeway your doctor will have.
But forgive me
and
for my
covered.
Forgive me for my skepticism of your interpretation, but I'm in a PPO now. It is covered by the laws of New York State as to the minimum requirements for coverage. Maybe there would be national minimum requirements for coverage, but that doesn't mean it would not be a PPO. That doesn't mean you would not have your choice of doctors. That doesn't mean it would be one size fits all. It means there would be minimum standards.
It doesn't mean that. Because, in fact, it doesn't say what it means, except in the Kennedy version, for example, it does spell out on pages 55 to 57 that it will have to include managed care controls, including a medical home, which is this decade's terminology for a gatekeeper. So you won't be able to just pick up the phone and make an appointment to see a specialist and expect that your insurance company will pay for it. That's just one example. The other reason that I'm so concerned about this legislation is that it's paid for not just with tax hikes, everybody's heard about those, but it's paid for with a $500 billion cut to future Medicare funding over the next decade. That's about a 10% cut in funding, at the same time that there'll be 30% more people enrolled in Medicare as the baby boomers age, and that means less money and more patients. Those numbers don't add up.
And that's the main thing that I wanted to talk to you about today, really, because that's been the thrust of the articles that you've been placing throughout the rest of the media. And my guest, if you're just joining us, is Betsy McCoy, who's been writing against the Obama health care plan, former lieutenant governor of New York State, among other things.
And, Brian, let me just say, since you used the word against, it's not just what I'm against, because you know I'm a patient advocate. I spend my time in hospitals helping patients avoid infections, and I want to help the uninsured. Nobody should lose their home or a lifetime of savings because they get sick and they didn't have insurance. In fact, I've put out a proposal to guarantee health insurance to those who can't afford it. But my concern is that this legislation makes seniors bear the brunt because so much of the funding is coming from reducing future Medicare dollars. And the fact is that we are going to have a very large increase in the number of people in Medicare. And with fewer dollars, it's going to mean fewer hip replacements,
yes,
fewer knee replacements,
well, maybe,
fewer angioplasty,
maybe,
fewer bypass surgeries.
Maybe. But I don't know.
That's, you know, you can't just brush it off as maybe. That's a very, very grave source of concern for seniors.
And I want to get into that, but I want to finish up on one piece of old business because people hearing you may have heard of this, and I want to get your take on this because the New Republic, fairly recently, the New Republic, which had published your original 1994 piece against the Clinton plan, has since disowned it as being riddled with falsehoods. They don't even have it on their website anymore.
Partisan sour grapes. That article won many prizes, very, very important prizes, including a National Magazine Award, and those prizes stand. So the new owners of the New Republic, they're very partisan, and I can't deal with people who are still have partisan reasons for disavowing an article that's over a decade old. We have pressing health care problems today, and we've got to make sure seniors get the care they need.
So your op-ed in the Journal last Wednesday was called Obama's Health Rationer-in-Chief, about the bioethicist Ezekiel Emanuel, brother of Rahm Emanuel, who has raised the fundamental question of who doctors serve. Do they serve only their individual patients or also a notion of the greater good? And Emanuel, as you quote him, wants the Hippocratic Oath to take a more society-wide view. But you find that scary, correct?
I do, and I'm not alone in that. Many physicians find it preposterous that a doctor's attention should be to anybody except the patient the doctor is caring for. What Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel argues that doctors should look beyond their ethical obligation to do everything possible for their own patient and to consider broader social issues, such as where the money could be better spent. But doctors have always been trained to know that their obligation is to achieve social justice one patient at a time.
But doctors do that and are asked to do that today. Aren't they to take a society-wide view? For example, doctors are more reluctant to prescribe antibiotics today than in the past because overuse of antibiotics as a society makes them lose their effectiveness society-wide. So is that wrong? Is the principle behind those decisions wrong?
Well, it is wrong when it comes to a matter of harboring resources and not giving them to the patient who needs them. Let me just explain why this is such a concern. And there are medical schools around the country who are adopting this new view. It's not just Dr. Emanuel. But I believe it's wrong. And many doctors share my viewpoint that a doctor's obligation must be focused on the patient who's being cared for.
But as a fundamental, and antibiotics is an easy example because they're prescribed wrongly in cases where there is only a virus and not a bacterial infection.
And by the way, it would be wrong for a doctor to say, I'm not going to give antibiotics to this patient who needs them because there's overuse in the hospital in general. A doctor's obligation is to do what is best for the patient.
But as a fundamental truth, when we talk about health care reform, we have to be honest about the word rationing. You and others, I think, scare us with the notion of government rationing, but we have massive rationing now in all kinds of ways. The market price of insurance is unaffordable for millions of people. That's rationing. Insurance companies declare some treatments experimental or not medically necessary. That's rationing. To make insurance more affordable, insurance gives you only 10 physical therapy sessions or it doesn't cover dental. I could list thousands of others. So do you agree that the real discussion is not whether to ration, but how to ration?
Well, actually, I disagree because, in fact, Washingtonians have made a big deal. The politicians have been again and again arguing that we need to spend less on health care. But 90% of the difference between what Americans and Europeans spend on health care is due to higher per capita income in the United States. We spend more on health care because we earn more, and the result is that we also get more. For example, women in the United States are far more likely to have age-appropriate mammograms than women in other countries. As a result, their breast cancer is diagnosed sooner, treated faster, and American women have the highest five-year survival rate for breast cancer.
Right, but there are examples on both sides. I tend to agree with your mammogram example and breast cancer survival rate example as an example of things that are done better in this country than in other countries, because that screening is so effective. But there are other ways where the United States throws money at health care in ways that don't lengthen life or improve the quality of life. And I see a liberal paradox and a conservative paradox in the health care rhetoric. And I see you as in the conservative paradox right now. The way I see it, liberals say we have to spend more on health care to cover everyone, and we have to get exploding costs under control. And people are left confused by that, including by the president, as to whether we're supposed to expect more from modern medicine or less under Obamacare.
I find it odd that you're pigeonholing me in this conservative paradox.
But I haven't framed it yet. Conservatives say, and I hear you saying this, we have to get costs under control first and foremost, and they talk against tax increases, as you just did. But then,
I haven't talked against tax increases. I have not talked about getting costs under control, because my major argument is that the United States can afford to spend more on health care.
Right.
We don't have to spend less on health care.
So as a group, and I'm sorry if I mistakenly pigeonholed you into the group that is against raising taxes for health care, but they say they're against raising taxes for health care and that we have to get costs under control first and foremost, and then they scare us by arguing against rationing.
Well, let me point out what my viewpoint is, because it's informed by my experience working with patients rather than what the politicians on either side of the aisle in Washington are saying. One of my concerns is that these bills involve a massive shift of resources from specialty medicine to primary care on the misconception that Americans overuse specialty care and drive up costs in the process. But the fact is,
and you think that's a misconception?
It is definitely a misconception. The fact is that, and this is just clear evidence in study after study.
And this is your main point. This is the Betsy McCoy point in this whole debate,
correct?
That's
right. Let me explain. Heart disease patients who are treated by generalists instead of specialists are much more frequently misdiagnosed and treated incorrectly. They are readmitted to the hospital much more often, and most importantly, they die sooner.
But who's saying heart disease patients shouldn't see cardiologists?
Because if you read these bills very carefully, have you, Brian?
I have not read them line by line.
I've read
massive press coverage on all sides.
There is in both bills, the Kennedy bill and the House bill, substantial shifts in resources, not only on how doctors are paid, but more importantly, on who's going to be trained to practice medicine in the future.
There are shifts in resources in that direction. You're right.
And it's going to mean shortage of specialty care, especially for seniors.
Well, we have a shortage of primary care now, and many experts say that we have less quality of life, maybe less length of life, because people aren't getting enough early care, the kind of early screening like you were rightly referring to with the mammograms that would lead them to need as many specialists.
That's right, but I want to take these specific bills, and I'm talking about the bills because we can have a really free-ranging discussion, but the bills are what's at stake here. And if these bills have incorrect provisions that will harm our care, we need to know about it now.
That's correct. But let me take an example.
Just a second, Brian. The provisions that shift funding from training specialty doctors, such as cardiologists and pulmonologists and oncologists, and shift it to primary care will mean less access to specialty care when older people need it.
Well, let me take one of your examples, and my guest is Betsy McCoy, who's written widely against aspects of the Obama health plan. Let's take an example from your Wall Street Journal op-ed last Wednesday about a drug for metastatic colon cancer that costs $50,000 but extends life by an average of only 2 to 5 months. I gather from your piece that Ezekiel Emanuel thinks this isn't a good thing for insurance to routinely cover. But you find that shocking.
Yes, I do, and I'll tell you why. Because when he refers to the average, how much longer it will enable a patient to live, 2 to 5 months, for example, that's a median. But what that really means is that some patients can survive that cancer because of that drug. You see, chemotherapy is a guessing game. A particular drug may help 20% of patients. You don't know, or we're beginning to learn through genetic markers, which patients can be helped by which drugs. But right now, it's not unusual to see a chemotherapy drug that will help 20% of patients and not 80%.
That's correct.
But we have to pay for those drugs because when a patient has exhausted the proven therapies and wants to live, that patient's only hope of life is taking a drug that perhaps only works 20% of the time.
And we would be united in arguing against the insurance company's denial of coverage for that experimental treatment. But don't you also have to look at the alternatives? Because if all that money is not spent on minimal extension of life for the terminally ill, then it can be spent on extending life much more for many more people.
But
isn't that the question?
You've just said something that's mistaken, Brian.
Isn't that the question that we are morally obligated to ask in the face of finite resources?
You, first of all, I'm going to debate you on whether we have to reduce healthcare spending. But let me point out what you just said that was incorrect. A minimal extension of life. I just explained to you that those are median figures, and what they obscure is the fact that the drug may not help 80% of patients at all, but it could enable the other 20% to live years.
So maybe there
and
are two different
their quality of life.
Okay, maybe there are two different categories here. One is a drug that might actually be a cure for 20% of people, which is kind of what you're talking about. The other is the kind of thing that the president cited to the New York Times. We did a couple of segments on this. He said we spent 80% of our health care dollars in the last 2 weeks of people's lives. Now, I think that overstates it.
It does. But, it's inaccurate.
But all the experts seem to agree we spent so much of our health care dollar in the last few weeks and months.
Well, let me point out the fallacy of that thinking. First of all, nobody sends you a postcard, and nobody sends your doctor a postcard letting you know when you're about to die. And doctors often don't know. But it is true that large dollars are spent in the last 6 months. That's usually the figures that you use, the last 6 months of a patient's life, because that's when patients get sick. If a 16-year-old kid is in a motorcycle accident, 95% of his health care is spent in the last month of his
right.
life.
But that's the 16-year-old kid is
a statistical oddity.
But that's a misleading example, the 16-year-old kid. We're
it
talking
isn't.
Overwhelmingly about people who are very elderly with things like widely metastatic cancer.
No, we're talking about the fact that it's unavoidable that most healthcare spending is spent toward the end of your life because generally before you die, you get sick. What is misleading about so much of the discussion these days is the misconception that living longer unfairly burdens society. What the research really shows is this. A person who lives to 100 spends only about a third as much on health care in the last 2 years of life as someone who lives to 65 or 70, because the older person is genetically predisposed to be healthy. And secondly, once people reach age 70, they tend to spend the same amount cumulatively on health care for the rest of their lives, whether they live another 5 years or another 25 years. That figure is $144,700. The people who live longer need less health care each year because, again, they are predisposed to be healthy until the end of their lives.
But then how do you explain the Medicare inflation rate? And you're coming on here, and another thing I want to make sure to challenge you on is your assertion that we should just keep spending more and more on Medicare. Medicare is in much more dire financial shape than Social Security. It's been growing so much faster than inflation for many years. It will necessitate...
Actually, there are some years when Medicare has not grown tremendously because we see a very dramatic decline in disability among the elderly, about 2% a year ever since 1987. And there were years like 2001 where per capita spending on Medicare actually did not increase at all. But let me point
out... But overall, Medicare is exploding. And people on both sides of the aisle in Congress say this is the thing that's going to devour the federal budget and force big tax increases as the baby boomer ages, baby boomers age much more than Social Security.
Ah, Brian, but there is a way to solve this problem without denying care to the elderly, and the Congressional Budget Office has pushed this remedy year after year. The fact is that if Medicare inched up the eligibility age 1 month a year until 2043 when it reached age 70, Medicare would be solvent. And that is what the Congress should do. And that is what the Congressional Budget Office has urged Congress to do every year. That would solve the problem without it's telling elderly people that they have to suffer with crippling arthritis rather than get a knee replacement.
We're going to run out of time soon, but how do you cover the 65-year-olds?
Well, first of all, 65 used to be a reasonable age, but many people who are 65 now are still working, and they are far more vital than they used to be. You know when that 65-year-old retirement and coverage came into being long before Medicare? It was invented by Bismarck in the 19th century. 65 is an anachronistic age to regard somebody as old and in need of government assistance.
Well, but people are getting laid off from the private sector at higher rates, and not just in the current recession.
That's another problem that I am very eager to solve by covering the uninsured, but let's not put that burden on Medicare. Let's solve Medicare's solvency without rationing against the elderly. They should not bear the brunt of this health care crisis. They should be guaranteed those procedures that enhance life in the golden years.
I want to conclude by playing you a montage of Newt Gingrich, Rush Limbaugh, and Senator Chuck Grassley.
I hope you don't represent me as being part of what those Washington politicians say. I'm a patient advocate.
I'm going to have a question for you. If you will acknowledge that they are lying or twisting the truth to exaggerate what the health reform plan would do, here's the 27-second montage.
You're asking us to trust turning power over to the government when there clearly are people in America who believe in establishing euthanasia, including selective standards.
He wants the White House, he wants the executive branch to be making determinations of who lives and who dies, which will lead to the regulation of every lifestyle or life in this country.
We should not have a government program that determines you're going to pull the plug on grandma.
How much truth, Betsy McCoy, how much willful distortion do you find in that montage?
I find the kernel of truth in that is that seniors bear the brunt under this legislation, and I want to make sure to protect them. Funding for Medicare should not be cut to cover the uninsured. There are other ways to do it. We can put Medicare
You keep saying funding for Medicare would be cut. It's the rate of growth that would be cut.
That's
not?
But Brian, 30% more people are going to be enrolled in Medicare at a time when they're cutting the future budget for Medicare, future projected funding, by 10%. The numbers don't add up, and it's going to mean unfair denials of treatment for elderly people. One of the greatest accomplishments of our country in the last 30 years has been to transform the experience of aging and protect elderly people from crippling arthritis.
Because of Medicare.
And we want to make sure that whatever is done for the uninsured, and I want to protect the uninsured, I want to make sure they have coverage, but it should not be on the backs of seniors.
So the kernel that I'm going to take out of this and follow up on with other guests in the coming days is whether moving the Medicare eligibility age to 70 will really solve the Medicare finance problem, as you assert.
And but please read the Congressional Budget Office report on this, because they have outlined the numbers. It's not a matter of partisan opinion. If they inch up that age 1 month a year until 2043, plenty of notice for people in their 30s and 40s to work until they're 66 instead of 65.
But on that Grassley, because he's the most serious of the three in the montage, and his lie to my ear is also the most direct, will you acknowledge that there is nothing in these bills that would pull the plug on grandma. He said, pull the plug on grandma, those words, which means the government deciding to remove someone from an oxygen tank or a feeding tube against their personal directive.
Yes, I think there's been much too much inflammatory partisan language by politicians on both sides. As you know, I'm not one of those. I read the bills. I'm a patient advocate. And my concern is, don't fund this legislation with reductions in future spending for Medicare. That's it. It's the wrong way to go. It's unfair to seniors. I want to make sure people can get those hip and knee replacements and stay on their feet.
And just to your credibility, the day after you were on with Jon Stewart, you resigned from the board of a medical device manufacturer.
That is
incorrect. That is
incorrect. That is incorrect. And the company has already written a letter to the Washington Times, the only newspaper that incorrectly reported that.
Are you still on the board?
And no. I resigned from that board long before I appeared on the Jon Stewart show. To ensure that no one thought I had a conflict of interest. And by the way, it is an infection prevention company on which I have sat so that I can present the hospital and patient point of view on what's needed.
Do they make medical devices?
They actually make all kinds of equipment, not sold in hospitals, but more sold to dialysis centers to prevent infection. It's cleaning equipment, masks, and things to prevent infection. But
And when you're on the board of a for-profit device company that would benefit from more funding.
Who are your advertisers?
The state. I don't take any money from anybody except my employer.
That's right. And who is your employer?
WNYC.
That's right. And I'm sure that WNYC gets contributions of all sorts from corporations.
If you want to say that's the same thing?
It is the same thing because I don't trade in that stock. I was there and I just was paid for my time like anybody else. I don't think many people come on your show without earning a living.
Yes.
But let me make it clear, you were incorrect to say I resigned from that board after appearing on the Jon Stewart show. I had resigned from that board to avoid this kind of suggestion that there was a conflict of interest.
Right.
I resigned before I went on any of these shows,
right.
And the company has made it very clear in writing that not once on the time I served on that board did we ever discuss federal issues, reimbursement issues, or political issues.
Right.
So that's just a low blow. It's totally unsupported by fact.
So
Let's stick to the issues,
okay.
Because on the issues, I'm the one who's right.
And the date of that resignation have been widely reported. So if we have cleared that up as a misconception here, I'm glad.
I am too, and I welcome a chance to come on your show and talk about health care again.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Betsy McCoy, among other things, chairman of the Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. Do you want casino gambling at the Aqueduct Racetrack?